Chief, in part two of this interview, I want to ask you some general questions about. I know that you and all the rest of us have been following what happened up in Newburyport and that tragic incident. And I know that for a lot of Gloucester folk, it brought back some horrible memories of the mid 1960s because there was a similar explosion in Gloucester that took the lives of two of our residents that still resonates today. So if I may, Chief, just a general question on the fire department's involvement in something like that, because you're called in, obviously, after the fact. There are noxious gases, probably fire and all that kind of stuff. So in general, what's the fire department's role in that kind of thing and maybe the aftermath as well?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing and always at the top of our list is life safety, right? So if any victims outside of the facility that are very obvious, you know, if you get there and it's a mass casualty, depending on, you know, if you've got more patients than you do immediate ability to treat and transport, you're into what we consider a mass casualty. So depending on the scope and size and number of victims that are involved, I mean, the first priority is always to render aid to people, right? We don't worry about the structure or the stuff unless not attending to the structure and the incident that's going on could actually put more lives at risk. Mm-hmm. That, you know, saying that maybe that fire, we could actually control it and put it out right now and keep it from jumping to some other highly flammable container that if it was to light up or let go, right, would result in further harm to more people. So again, it's that incident commander who gets there that's got to size up that building and figure out what is the best tactic based on the current conditions that they find. And taking care of the people is the number one priority. Mm-hmm. And if that means put the fire out first, then go actually physically touch them, then that may have to take place in some circumstances. Mm-hmm. But in these instances, most explosions that come from chemical products that are contained either in a vessel or leak out of containment piping and accumulate and get to an explosive level and let go within side a structure or some kind of box, if you will, right? And they let go. Those detonations often do result in fire. They're typically not massive fires. Sometimes they are. It depends on the product and what was leaking, if it's still leaking and flammable and burning. But a lot of times, like, you know, we see with natural gas explosions in homes and businesses, smaller businesses, frequently that fire is a big fireball, a big eruption, mm-hmm. and then most of it goes out because mm-hmm. it's just a big flash and an explosion. Now that detonation and the concussion and the damage that it causes are incredible, mm-hmm. right? It's a bomb going off. It's a grenade going off. So it is a big deal. And the firefighting side of it, sometimes is kind of the minimal piece. But you're right. There's all of those things that have to be considered. The people, what else is still going on? Is it still burning? Is there other mm-hmm. detonations we have to worry about? What were the chemicals that released? Mm-hmm. What are the products of combustion that are in the air or in the area? What exposure risks are there and how do we address that? Not only for the citizens and the people immediately involved, but for those first responders that are getting to that incident. Mm-hmm. Are they properly equipped and geared and in the right spots? So it's a lot to consider. And this is why there's such kind of tight controls and oversight and reporting and all those things, in these industries that have some of these very volatile chemicals and hazardous chemicals. And why it's so tightly watched. And unfortunately, you know, again, it's the human error factor or, you know, and even human error when there's sometimes mechanical failure because the human element, mm-hmm. That should have said, no, that's too old for us to keep using. We need to replace it. We need to fix it. You know, sometimes if the money's not there, it gets deferred, and then bad things can happen. So, and I have no idea about the circumstance up in Newbury.
Right.
So please don't.
No, I know. I know.
I have no idea what happened.
Nope.
I don't even know what chemicals were
involved. That's why I'm not asking specifically, of course.
I haven't even had a chance to kind of, you know, armchair quarterback that they had going on up there. And
but let me ask you one other question, because I know that particularly in Blackburn Circle, we have a lot of interesting businesses there that deal with some really high-tech stuff and some low pressures and high pressures and gases and all that stuff. And I'm sure throughout the North Shore, there's all kinds of stuff, you know, of that same nature. Who's responsible for checking on safety, oversight, I guess is the word I'm looking for safety issues? I mean, you know, like the Board of Health will check restaurants and things like that. How does that work for those kinds of chemical companies or you know, high-risk situations?
Right. So for most of the chemical companies and those businesses that are dealing with it, they're required to do a lot of self-reporting and self-inspection and pushing that information out to those that need to know. Mm-hmm. The companies that fall under Tier 2 level sites, which are, you know, within the federal laws and different chemicals and quantities thereof, tick off a responsibility on their part to report that amount of chemical, where it's stored, and so forth, to the fire chief and to the local emergency responding, you know, forces in that area. So the LEPCs, planning committees, and so forth, that they have to kick that up to. So there's a lot of you know, notices provided and paperwork provided, and in what they contain, what they have, how they handle it. If they're doing processing in this state, if they're mixing chemicals together that can create a reaction, and they know that, you know, this is part of what they do, they have to permit those processes, and it's all dependent on the size of how big of a container that they have, because obviously the bigger the container, the more volatile the chemical, then the higher risk it is, and the tighter controls and requirements for reporting and inspections and so forth kind of ramp up. And we're fortunately, we don't have but maybe one or two companies that does hazardous processing where they're mixing things together that could create a reaction and have a problem. We do have a lot of pretty ugly, nasty chemicals. We have a pretty significant, you know, electronics, you know, development with Applied Materials and many other companies in town that do work that require some hazardous chemicals, but they're in very low quantities and they're very tightly controlled and regulated, which is good for the community that we don't have a lot of it. But they are out there, but they're everywhere.
Yeah.
Every community you go to is going to have nasty stuff in it, because that's, as consumers, the things that we want and the things that we demand to be produced for us, that's what it takes. It uses a lot of nasty, ugly chemicals to make the things that we use all the time, microchips and everything else. It's, you know, the chemicals are very volatile, and like we kind of say in the industry, at least my saying is, you know, it's a bad day when the genie gets out of the bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to know how to handle that. In this state, we actually have 6 hazmat teams that are state-funded, state-managed, and they are staffed by firefighters throughout all of our communities, depending upon if you have qualified people. So they kind of grab the best of the best that have all the right training to create these teams, and that's how they respond to it. In the last area that I was at, Michigan, I was on one of those teams. We did a very similar thing, only it was done at the regional level, not at state level. So it was always kind of a fist fight to get funding and equipment that you needed. Here in Mass, I think we are doing it probably better than most places, because it's statewide and it's very organized, it's very well funded and equipped, and they train a lot. And they do train here in town. We've had them in town.
Mm-hmm.
In the last 11 years that I've been here, we've probably had them in town at least 6 times, training at various facilities and so forth, just because they want to stay familiar. So those are the efforts that go into it. There's not a ton that the fire service does directly day in and day out with those, other than make sure that those that have regulated obligations, that they're fulfilling them with their inspections and reporting. And then we have to do site-specific training with those places that do have those Tier 2s. So we're doing walkthroughs with them. We're getting to know their sites. We get to know where their products are and how well they handling it, but we're not a hazmat response team in this fire department, right? We depend on the state's team because it's really, really, really expensive to do that work. And so that's why the state developed the hazmat team approach that we have, because there's very few communities that can afford it. You know, Boston Fire, I believe, has a pretty resilient team. Maybe Worcester has their own internal team that they can call upon, as well as some of the other big cities that have pretty good financial resources and really the geography and the demand to have their own, really. It's just simpler if you own it yourself and you don't have to wait on anybody. But it costs a lot of money, and you gotta be able to afford it, and you have to have the need, which means you have the problem, right? And we're not gonna pay for a service like that if we don't ever use it.
All right, that's Gloucester Fire Chief Eric Smith with MSO News Sports. I'm Rick Moore.